Bible study for the 21st of August, 1990, Peter Chesset, and the topic is John 8, 1 to 11. There are a number of titles. The one I've got in front of me is The Accused and the Guiltless. That's the one that's on the board also. I'd like to start by just repeating what I did yesterday. My bookstore commercial, but I think it's also important because it fits in with what we're doing this week. Last week I was very encouraging that people read and buy Raymond Brown's summation of what he feels about John's theology and the Johannine community. The book that I think he published, was it 70, 71? The Community of the Beloved Disciple, The Life, Loves, and Hates of an Individual Church or Community in the New Testament Times. And those of you who've been with me for 2 weeks will realize that I bow with great respect in the presence of Raymond Brown, which means that it's going to be all the more startling at the end of this hour when we get to the interpreter and I read for you some of Raymond Brown's statements about this text that make me a little less overwhelmed and awed in my hero worship. But that's just to get your ideas moving on this one. That was the book I recommended last week. The book I'm recommending this week, it's for sale in the bookstore, is The Word Disclosed by Gail O'Day. And if I go through again today the titles of her chapters, you will probably see why. The first chapter is titled, From the Comfort of Slogan to the Risk of Experience. That's her reading of John 3, 1 to 15, the Nicodemus figure. The next chapter is one that I will be using quite extensively in the Bible study tomorrow on Renaissance Day, From the Comfort of Tradition to the Risk of Experience. And that's the drama, like the drama we did yesterday. In the fourth chapter of John, 4 to 42, and we're going to deal with that text tomorrow somewhat in the same way we dealt with the Martha Mary text yesterday. Then the third chapter in her book is The Risk of Experience. How do we know, how do we see? John 9, 1 to 41, the whole text on the man born blind and Jesus giving this man sight, and then the discussion of Jesus as the light of the world, and then at the very end of that chapter, the provocative statement to the Pharisees, you had no guilt before, but now that you say you see, your guilt is increased, and the whole typically Johannine back and forth about who is the seeing one and who is the blind one. This one we're not going to hit front and center. And then from the risk of experience to the gift of life, this is what we did yesterday. And those of you who were here yesterday know that I depended on Gail O'Day. I didn't put it on the board, but I remind those of you who were here last week that my theme to help us unlock these things last week was the equation life equals struggle. And Gail O'Day's titles here, From Comfort to Risk, that's just about the same area of meaning. John's gospel is inviting us into newness, new thinking. I think John's gospel, in terms of its historical context, was inviting the Christians in that beloved community to think about the Jesus tradition in a deeper and somewhat different way from the way that Mark, Matthew, and Luke and their communities thought about it. That's the way we're setting it up for this week. I did not put it on the board because I didn't have time, but the last chapter or the conclusion in her book is Do Not Hold Me, John 20, 1 to 18. And I mentioned that in passing yesterday, and we'll touch on it just briefly today. That's the Mary Magdalene passage, and we'll be dealing with that on Thursday after the Renaissance Fair is over. That's the commercial, Gail O'Day, the word disclosed. I don't know whether, I haven't checked the bookstore. When we moved into this week, there were 7 copies left out of the 10 she had ordered. And I just want you to know that they've told me, I don't know whether they can carry through on their threat, that I will have to buy the books that are not sold. So we'll see. Then the review on the, can you see the outline up here, or should I move around so you can see it? The what I plan to do is do a slight review of yesterday, although that's what A there, M and M means. Then suggest something about the 7 texts in John that deal with women, where women are prominent. It will be only a suggestion, that's why the question mark is there. Then the next section is the difficult history of this text. Why did it take so long for this text to find a home? Mm-hmm. Then we'll do something like we did yesterday, do some program notes or some marking of the score before we publicly read the text. But in distinction from the way we went at it yesterday, a very important part of what I want to do today, if we lurch through this successfully, is to look at the interpreter. Because it seems to me that this text illustrates very nicely what difference it makes, who is looking at the text, and from what point of view the interpreter comes. So that's the plan. The review is, for the, how many were here yesterday? Let's just see. Okay, well, there's not much need for a lot of review then, but we looked at both Martha and Mary as each one was led by Jesus through an experience of deepening faith, moving from, remember, Martha's classic confession, which had several meanings. One of them is, in John's recasting of the tradition, that in Martha's mouth, he places, or they place, the confession that is so important in Peter's mouth, in Matthew's gospel particularly, but in the other gospel. That's one dimension. The other dimension is that as the story is unfolded, the very, very intentional drama which that story is, Martha moves from that to her statement, which is not so praiseworthy, when Jesus wants to raise Lazarus and saying, "Oh Lord, already he smells, and you're sure you want to do this?" And Jesus moves her from there into the experience of new life. And Mary, too, is moved through this text to a deeper understanding of what faith means. Now, this is partly review, and partly just, the next point is partly review, and partly just to open up your thinking a little bit about what Jesus in the first place, and then secondly, the echo of Jesus in the Johannine community wants to say first to their context and then to the Christian community down through the centuries about the role of women in the faithful community, or the community of the faithful, the community, the beloved community gathered in the name of Jesus. C.H. Dodd's commentary on John is one of the most difficult and one of the most interesting. It's in the library. I checked that out the first week to see which ones were there. And C.H. Dodd wants to interpret that whole first section from the middle of chapter 1 to the end of chapter 2 as the Book of Signs. And he said it's very, very significant that when you follow my interpretation, C.H. Dodd's interpretation, you have seven great signs. The number seven is terribly important. And John is saying, on the subliminal level, or on the level that you will discover if you really think about this text, that the number seven signs will tell you there's a kind of completeness there. Well, it's very interesting that there are really seven texts in John which deal with women, where the women are prominent. Let me just run through it, suggest something, and then put the question mark behind what I suggest, and then go on from there to the next point, the difficult history of the text. The seven places in John's Gospel where women sort of come to the front of the stage and take the action. The first one, Mary, mother of Jesus, in chapter 2, the wedding at Cana, really being the one who initiates or inaugurates Jesus' public ministry. The second of the seven, the woman of Samaria, our drama for tomorrow. The third one, the text for today, the woman who is accused. The third one, the one we did yesterday, the fourth one, I mean, Martha and Mary. The next one, chapter 12, which we've only touched on, Mary anointing Jesus in chapter 12. Then the sixth one, chapter 19, 25 to 27, which we're going to look at in the next couple days from a couple points of view, the women gathered at the foot of the cross. And then, of course, chapter 20, which I looked at with you in a preliminary way yesterday, in an introductory way, Mary Magdalene, the one that also has Thomas there, chapter 20, the first witnesses to the resurrection. Now, the reason there's a question mark up here, of course, is that it's wonderful to play with number seven here and to say, what is the author, or are the authors of John saying with these seven texts? But the problem is, and now we're moving down here to the difficult history of this text, is that this text wasn't part of the seven until quite late in the manuscript tradition. Now open your Bibles to John 8, 1 to 11, and somebody with better bifocals than I, please read the footnote there about the history of this text. I can read the first four words. The most ancient authorities, will somebody read that? Really belt it out so everybody can hear.
The most ancient authorities omit 7 verse 53 to 8 verse 11. Other authorities add the passage here or after 7 verse 36 or after 21 verse 25 or after Luke 21:38 with variations of text.
Now, when you enter seminary, and how many have are seminary graduates here? Okay, when you enter seminary, you are forced, at least we were, to study the history of the text and textual criticism. And it is, in a sense, a terribly boring thing. You have to memorize the different families and traditions of manuscripts, How was the Bible done in the early days? You got a manuscript, and then a monk would stand in front of a room full of scribes and read off the manuscript. And they would copy it, and then they would send or sell these copied manuscripts to different areas. So you had, when you were doing textual criticism, sort of families or groups of texts. You had the Eastern text, the Byzantine text, which was what now we call the Eastern Orthodox Church. You had a text tradition that was sort of gathered around Alexandria and Egypt, because that was an intellectual center. You had a text gathered around Syria, and then you had the so-called Western text, which is associated with the church at Rome and the precursors of that enterprise at Rome. Now, the interesting thing about this text is that if you look at the ancient manuscripts from the East, this text isn't in there until 900. This text didn't make it into the manuscript copying rooms of the Eastern Orthodox tradition until about 900. Brown, who does this carefully, and I reread it yesterday so I would have some details in my mind to share with you, says, however, there's very, very good evidence in the Western or tradition related to Rome and so forth that this text was in the manuscripts by the 4th century. That's the 300 years. But the interesting thing, it's more complicated than that. Because there are some church fathers who quote this text way down in the 2nd century. That's the 100 years, you know. From 0 to 100 is the 1st century, and from 100 to 200 is the 2nd century. So it's quoted in church fathers as early as some of the manuscripts we have for some of the stuff in the New Testament. Now what's going on here? Why did it take this text so long to find a home in the canon? You see, textual criticism does not have to be boring. There are 10 or 12 places in the New Testament where you have this dust up in the manuscript tradition, and they are all theologically important. If you were doing the John course with me at seminary, and we were taking a whole term to do it, we'd spend not the whole time like Rosenthal's did on the prologue, but we'd spend some time on the prologue. And very, very interesting when you get to the point of where, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Boy, do you have a lot of controversy in the textual tradition there. You look at the old manuscripts, and these people who were sort of copying out into manuscripts out in the room where the chief monk was reading, some of them didn't write down what he was dictating because they had theological convictions and weren't going to be pushed around. So it's fascinating. Why didn't this text find a home early? A man by the name of Riesenfeld did an interesting study there, is over against the Eastern situation, why the text didn't make it into the canon in the Eastern Church, and he says, and apparently proves it, I did not reread the study, although I looked at it once, but Brown summarizes it here and says, it's because they had such a strict penitential system in the ancient church in those early years, and this one didn't fit in. It didn't fit in, and only when the system of penance in the Eastern church loosened up was there room in the piety and in the canon of the Eastern church for this text. I think we're going to come back to that when we discuss the interpreter. Why did it take so long to find a home in the Eastern tradition and even in the Western tradition? Because it was a little bit too much of a challenge to the piety and tradition of the early Christian community. From the comfort of tradition to the risk of experience. Okay, let's let that one simmer a little bit. Just remember that this magnificent text couldn't find a home in the canon. It came like a beautiful gospel bird and tried to light and was pushed away by the ecclesiastical authorities.
Just a question of okay. Curiosity. Are there other ancient texts about Jesus that never made it into the canon?
Oh, that's fun. That's a lot. You have another course that you're forced to take, and it doesn't get exciting until you get out of seminary often, is a course on canon building and what got into the canon. There are certain scholars that have gathered together gospels that didn't make it. There's a gospel of the Hebrews, and there are other gospels that didn't make it in. And in my review yesterday of some of the stuff on this text found a home for a while, apparently, in the gospel of the Hebrews. At least one of the ancient fathers who quoted this text early, said, "And the story of the adulteress in the gospel of Hebrews," and this father's not forgot the name, discussion of it reflects knowledge of the text in detail as we have it. So there were a number of gospels or gospel stories that didn't make it. There's an interesting work called the Didache, which is the teaching of the early churches, and it is in some of the early lists of authoritative books and then just didn't make it down through the centuries. It sort of an also ran in the canonical race. But scholars have looked at the Didache and worked at it and figure that in chapters 9 or wherever it is, there are Eucharistic prayers embedded there that are older than some of the Eucharistic material, even in Paul. So you get this interesting drama if you look carefully at the manuscripts. Now, I wanted to, is that enough?
Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to go at the text now. I want to save some room for the interpreter, but do a little bit on, like we did yesterday, on program notes and questions. Now the text is familiar to most of you, at least you remember this, because it's dramatic. They've caught this woman in the act of adultery, and they bring her into the temple precincts, very interesting, to Jesus. Now, one of the questions that you have to ask, that scholars have asked, this is for the program notes, or putting in the margin of the score as we listen to the movement or the song. Did they bring her to Jesus for trial or for sentencing? One of the questions behind the question is, when exactly and with what consistency did the Romans forbid the Jewish Sanhedrin to continue giving the death penalty? Now there's some give and take, some controversy in the scholarship, and we're not going into that. But you have evidence in the rest of the gospel tradition that it was probably taken pretty seriously, that the Sanhedrin no longer had the right to of life or death. They did some regulation of the Jewish community, as for instance under colonialism in southern Africa, traditional law, the chiefs and their groups had jurisdiction over certain things, but the English and Rhodesian, I'm sure the Afrikaner in South Africa had the final word. Now, what's going on here? That's just a question to have in the back. Then, one reason why most scholars say that this text has got to be authentic, even if it had a hard time getting into the canon, is that it reflects the kind of exchange that Jesus had with the Jewish authorities. And let's just illustrate that. I'm not doing too well on time, but we'll take time. Mark 12:13-17. Mark 12:13-17, that's the famous one where they're going to trick him. They say, is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar or not? Mm-hmm. That's sort of the catch-22. If he says it's not lawful, resist, then he could be taken in by the Roman authorities. If he says go ahead and pay it, it doesn't make any difference. Then the zealots and the patriots will say, see, he's just another collaborator. So they got him both ways. Somebody read this just to see that it's, read it.
And they sent to him some of the Pharisees and some of the Herodians to entrap him in his talk. And they came and said to him, Teacher, we know that you are true and care for no man, for you do not regard the position of men, but truly teach the way of God. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?
And that, did you see how slippery they were? We really think you're great. You're wonderful, okay?
Should we pay them or should we not? But knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, why put me to the test? Bring me a coin and let me look at it. And they brought one. And he said to them, whose likeness and inscription is this? They said to him, Caesar's. Jesus said to them, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And they were amazed at him.
Give God what belongs to God, and give Caesar what belongs to Caesar. And scholarship and piety has been still trying to figure out what Jesus really meant by that. But I think that's the way Jesus operated. He didn't come out with, this is the law, and write this down. When he told parables or when he interacted with the crowds and so forth, he left a lot of room for thinking.
Couldn't that be an argument for a separation of church and state? We mustn't mix up church and politics?
Well, it certainly has been used that way. But then you push it down a little farther and you think about it and say, now, in terms of where Jesus was coming from, what belongs to God?
Everything.
Everything. Mm-hmm. And what belongs to Caesar? Nothing. And Jesus is saying, you figure that one out. You figure that one out. So how do you answer a question? With another question.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that pushes the questioner often from the comfort of slogan, from the comfort of tradition, to the risk of taking control of your own life and answering your own questions in the light of the light of the world, and moving, therefore, into light. At least that's the interpretive wavelength we're on this week. I want to do another one on program notes before we read this one. And that is, we're going to look at the two issues when we get into the interpreter, and they're raised by the text. There are two issues that we have to see here. And I think they're embedded in this text legitimately, but they weren't always looked at the way that we look at them today. These are people that are both alive. Raymond Brown is alive and Rachel Wallenberg is alive. They are our contemporaries who are looking at this text through our eyes and the questions we ask. The two issues which are separable, but related, of course, are women's rights and sexuality. Both general topics that need some definition and refinement in the light of this text. But on the issue of women's rights, I want us to read, by way of preparation for hearing the text, Matthew 19, 3-9, which is out of the authentic Jesus tradition. One reason your scholars are very sure that this is authentic Jesus tradition is that one of the fancy titles you use for that in New Testament scholarship is the criterion of, it has different names, dual dissimilarity, or just absolutely sure is authentic Jesus. Mm. Now here you have Jesus being much tighter about divorce than the Jews were, and I don't know that much about the divorce practices in the early Christian community, but I don't think the early Christian community was as hard as this statement here. I'm not sure about that, but let's read it. 19:3-9, okay?
And Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" He answered, "Have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. So they are no longer two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder."
That's in our wedding ceremony, right?
Right.
Okay.
They said to him, "Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" He said to them,
notice before he goes into this, Jesus is in a sense putting down Moses here. Listen carefully.
"For your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so."
Say that again.
"And from the beginning, it was not so."
What's he talking about?
Creation.
Jesus seems to be talking about creation, and in their dry run at 7:30, several people said that's a very consistent interpretation of the commandment, "Thou shalt not commit adultery," as it's touching. Okay, let's go on. "From the beginning it was not so.
And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for unchastity, and marries another, commits adultery."
And this "except for unchastity," if we want to talk about the drama of the texts, some texts don't have that in there. Some texts don't have that in there. So you've got, again, this little theological and piety jockeying. Some texts say whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. In the terms of the society of that time, everybody, all the scholars say, this was an incredible stand for the protection of women. Because the tradition at the time of Jesus, how many know the name Joachim Jeremias? Joachim Jeremias is one of the great German, somewhat conservative, but very, very thorough New Testament scholars, who had the advantage of growing up in Jerusalem. His dad was a pastor to the German congregation there, and so Joachim Jeremias at 12 knew more Hebrew than I knew at 30 after studying it at seminary and teaching it at seminary. And he wrote, the first big book that he wrote was Jerusalem at the Time of Jesus, and his discussion of this is very interesting. a daughter or a wife was property. Property. And there were some laws gathered around the dowry. The dowry was supposed to be the woman's life insurance in case she was put away by her husband, but there were setups that got the husbands out of that. And for Jesus to come and say, you do not divorce your wife, was a strong impulse toward treating women not as property, but as people with rights. Just let that's part of the program notes as we read our text. Now, a question. I think I put that up there, didn't I? Program notes and questions. As we read it, I want you to let your poetic or dramatic or theological imagination ask the question, what did Jesus write on the ground the first time? And what did Jesus write on the ground the second time? If you survey the literature, all kinds of people with good imaginations filled in those two blanks. And then I would like you to ask yourself, as we read through the text, and we're going to do that now, how did it feel to be that woman? How did it feel to be that woman? And what did she experience dramatically through the words of Jesus? Okay, now with the program notes, with the score marked, let's listen to somebody, and we'll have one voice do it, I think, today. John 8, 1 to 11. We've got some time, we've got 25 minutes left.
They went each to his own house, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now, in the law of Moses, commanded us to stone such. What do you say about her?"
I'm sorry, but I'm interrupting again. Notice, whose law?
Moses.
Same figure that Jesus took on in the Matthew warm-up passage, okay?
"What do you say about her?" This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." And once more he bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the eldest. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus looked up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and do not sin again."
Okay, let's start with the last question I asked first. What did it feel like to be that woman?
She was scared to death. She knew the rules.
Scared to death. She knew the rules. And what did Jesus do with the rules?
Turned them around.
He turned something back on the accusers, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He said he didn't break the rules. He didn't break the rules, or did he?
Set them aside.
He redirected them.
This was what we would call almost forced reinterpretation, right?
Mm-hmm. I don't think he did. Didn't he, instead of reinterpreting him, didn't he put a condition on who would apply the rule? Didn't he say, he didn't really reinterpret or change the rule, didn't he say, if you're going to do it, then the one who's going to apply the rule has to be the one who's without sin?
Okay, it's very interesting. I don't know, I'm not sure that I can play the word game with you, but I can move away a little bit and say, He didn't say that Moses didn't know what he was talking about. That he did not say.
Right.
But he said, okay, let's see how this rule works in life according to my criteria. Let the guiltless one begin enforcing this rule.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was left of the rule when the episode was over?
The rule wasn't.
Not much.
He didn't confound the rule. He set it aside. He said, basically took the authority of not enforcing it.
Did he take the authority of not enforcing it? Or did he ask the right?
He said only, I don't condemn you. Go and don't sin again.
I don't think he set it aside. I think he said it applies to everyone,
mm-hmm.
not just this woman.
Well, aren't we talking about direction? Because the Pharisees were directing this rule, the accusers were directing the rule towards the woman that they had caught. And Jesus directed the rule towards everybody.
Mm-hmm.
He made it a broad spectrum instead of just a very narrow...
We don't know, but how many women were in the crowd with rocks in their hands? Just let your imagination go.
No, there were no women in the crowd that I can perceive.
They probably weren't free to be in the crowd.
That's right.
They weren't. It was the men accusing this one woman that they had caught. And the other thing that I wonder in my imagination is how many of those men that were accusing her had slept with that woman,
yeah.
that they knew she was the one that they could catch and bring before Jesus.
Question?
Yeah.
Could Jesus have told him that it was okay to kill him? I mean, did he have that authority?
Well, he would be the guiltless.
I mean, it says that he brought her for a test. It's almost like, I mean, that he didn't have any authority to say yes.
That's back to the question. Why did they bring her to Jesus?
They wanted to get him.
Yeah.
They were after him. They were after him. We, the readers and the first readers, would ask your question. Jesus is the Lord of life. Faith says that, right?
Yeah.
So he could have said, go
but
ahead.
If he didn't break the rule, he made it apply to every sin, not just adultery.
He made it apply to every sin and not just adultery.
Like it wasn't just the letter of the law, it was more the spirit of the law.
I think of another passage where he equates lust with adultery, and you know, that you're guilty of adultery in your heart if you lust after a married woman.
That is not in John. That is in the synoptic tradition, and I'm getting back to it. That sets me up for something I want to say later. You were going to say something.
Well, I was just going to say that the rule implies that the righteous stone the guilty. That's the way the rule is set up.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus is just saying none of us are righteous. And so the rule...
None of us is guiltless.
And none of us are guiltless.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rule just doesn't make any sense anymore. We're in a new age. It's just like when somebody asks, well, who's my neighbor?
Mm-hmm.
It's a new age with the rule.
Okay, I think all of this is generating the kind of reaction we want. I want to get into the interpreters in a minute, but I want to first ask, rather playfully but also rather seriously, what did Jesus write the first time? Yes.
Who is the man?
What else might Jesus have written the first time?
I was wondering if he might have written an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. You know, if they were to stone her for adultery, shouldn't she also be able to stone them for their adultery?
One thing I'm sure of, the text doesn't tell us what Jesus wrote. But the interesting thing, if you'd been getting ready for this like I have, is to read sometimes with a chuckle and sometimes with amazement what the scholars think maybe Jesus wrote. What did Jesus write the second time? Yes?
Well, I don't want to be irreverent, but the first thing that came to my mind is just about the man who hit a car and then got out of his car and took a piece of paper and wrote something down, and wrote down there all the people standing around here think I'm writing down my name and my insurance company, and he puts it on the windshield and goes back in his car. Maybe Jesus was just making fun of them. and letting them guess what he was writing.
Okay, that was what somebody said in the first time, that Jesus was just slowing down the action and just diddling around in the sand.
That's what I was thinking. I think he was just doodling and waiting for their tempers to just get to a point of, aren't you going to do anything about this? And then going, well.
I think it's a wonderful question because there's no right and wrong answer. It's just marvelous.
Yeah.
Some of the scholars said the second time he was writing the names of the men in the crowd that Jesus knew. And so I don't know. But let's move from this, because I want some discussion at the end, to the interpreter. Remember when I, those of you who were with me last Monday when we started a week ago, I quoted a South African theologian that Jim knows, Masala is his name, who challenges us in the West to say most of the European and American white male interpreters have never really taken the trouble to interpret themselves as they interpret the scripture, or to interpret the scripture itself in terms of 4 points. Class, race, sex, and ideology. And as a way of using the 17 minutes we've got, I want us to begin to look in that spirit at how this text gets interpreted. And I have got, yes, a man, and yes, a woman. Because it seems to me that how you begin to interpret this text depends an awful lot, and we've already touched on that, on where this text sat in terms of the racial, sexual, class, I don't know how to deal with a class exactly, and ideological context out of which it came, and then also with the race, class, sex, and ideology of the interpreters. Now, I've said that Raymond Brown is one of my heroes, and he is. But in his coming down for a landing on interpreting this text, he is very, very male, and I would say very Roman Catholic. A couple people after the warm-up said, Peter, you're being pretty hard on the Roman Catholics. Well, I said, that's kind of a Lutheran thing to do. But it's very interesting. Let me read for you what he says. And it touches on not only the women's rights, but it touches on a very touchy subject for all of us, but think of how touchy it is for Roman Catholics, sexuality, just generally. He has just repeated in his discussion verse 7. The man among you who has no sin, let him be the first to cast a stone at her. And then Brown says, you can almost feel the fear and the threat that he feels in this. Some have used this to paint their portrait of the liberal Christ and have turned it into a maudlin, that's not a loaded word, a maudlin justification for indifference toward sins of the flesh. One thing we're not going to allow is indifference toward sins of the flesh. However, and then this is another thing that sort of threatens authority, however, or you intuit in it that Brown sees this text as a threat to authoritative structures. However, Jesus is not saying that every magistrate must be sinless to judge others, a principle that would nullify the office of judge. How did that get into there? How did that get into there? I mean, this marvelous balanced scholar is scared in the presence of this wonderful text. He is dealing here with zealots who have taken upon themselves the indignant enforcement of the law, and he has every right to demand that their case be thoroughly lawful and their motives be honest. Now, this is nothing wrong with this. He recognizes that although they are zealous for the word of the law, they are not interested in the purpose of the law, for the spiritual state of the woman is not even in question, or whether or not she is penitent. That word again? Penitent. Moreover, Jesus knows that they are using her as a pawn to entrap you. Fair enough, fair enough. But you can just feel what he's going through as he writes these words. Then the next section I got to explain a little bit. There's a man by the name of Durrett, D-E-R-R-E-T-T, on whose work Brown is dependent. And Durrett apparently has done more than you folks did in filling in the blanks on Jesus' writing. He's reconstructed a whole probable drama here where the husband is trying to get rid of his wife, so he sets her up and then has his witnesses come in. The whole thing, it's not there at all. Mm-hmm. But let's read it. Even further, if Durrett is correct, the husband of the woman may have cynically arranged to have her caught by carefully prearranging there be witnesses to her sin. Durrett is presupposing that it's the woman that's playing around, right? Okay, instead of seeking to win back her love. The base motives of the judges, the husband, and the witnesses are not according to the law, and Jesus has every right to challenge their attempt to secure the woman's conviction. Understood in the light of these circumstances, verse 7, the man among you who has no sin, let him be the first to cast a stone. Makes sense. And above all, that verse better make sense, right? And then, remember we're talking about the interpreter now, and then a surprising sentence. I had to read it again. I had remembered it and I had it in my notes and I thought, did Brown really say that? And he did, and I'll read it to you. He said, the last sentence here, but one should beware of attempts to make it a general norm forbidding enactments of capital punishment. How did that get in there? Now, I think it's not unfair to read it this way. This text has scared the interpreter, Raymond Brown. Because it threatens the penitential system, it threatens the Roman Catholics hedging sexuality about with all kinds of laws, it threatens the structure of society which practices capital punishment. It is a massive threat. The title that Raymond Brown gives to this text is The Adulteress. The title that Rachel Walberg gives to this text in her book, Jesus According to a Woman, how many have read the book? Okay, you know more about it than I have then, I do then, is Jesus and the Adulterous Men. Jesus and the Adulterous Men. And if you think back on the story, that is not an incorrect title.
Well, in sociology, they talk about the scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
And by having society look at a person or a group of persons and label them as sinful or as criminals, that enables the rest of society to be cohesive and to feel better than,
mm-hmm.
and to polarize. And that has a function in society of making the society have one a sense of unity.
Why does this text strike fear in our beloved Raymond Brown? And why, according to Rachel Walberg, does this text give almost the greatest comfort of any text in the scripture to the new wave of feminist interpretation? Before you answer that, let me ask you, how many of you have worked in or read from Phyllis Trible's very famous short monographed Texts of Terror? There are four texts that Phyllis Tribble in this book looks at. One is the Hagar text. Remember Hagar? The concubine of Abraham, who asked by Sarah to bear a child so that the stream would not die out, does that. And then when Sarah has her own child, Hagar is cast with Ishmael into the wilderness. One text of terror. The next text of terror, Tamar, the princess who was raped and then discarded because she was damaged property. Then the text of terror that Nita, is that the name? Hill read in one of her sections last week, Judges 19. Remember that story of the concubine who was finally, after the men outside of this house had asked for males to have sex with, and the host says, no, we can't do that, so he sends out the concubine of this old man, and she is raped through the night, and then dying and exhausted, she's found on the, or is crawled to the doorstep in the morning, and then her master kills her and cuts up her body in pieces and distributes it around in the area of the so-called Holy Land. And it's a text of terror. I remember we read that at a service at Wartburg Seminary the next day after this man in Canada shot all the women, remember, up there. Talk about raw terror. And then, of course, you have the fourth text of terror in Phyllis Tribble's book, The Daughter of Jephthah, who is the virgin who is sacrificed. Well, this is something that nobody talked about. Reverend Rustin didn't tell me about these texts in confirmation. He didn't. But they were there. And feminist interpretation has made us look at these texts and say, that's what we have been, has come to us out of the biblical tradition. And you look at this thing in terms of what this text presupposes, and that is, at the time of Jesus, women were property. So it's not at all surprising that this text is looked at from the feminist point of view as the great liberation text, or a great liberation text, because what is Jesus saying? Jesus is saying the verdict that the Moses law gave is one that will not be enforced here. Okay, you had it.
I think to support that, one sentence in here that kind of tickles me is that the eldest guy got out of there first.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's been around.
He knew.
That's right. But they all left.
Yeah. Yeah.
They all left. It's an absolutely magnificent text. Now, we got about 7 minutes left, and I want to just say that what we've discussed here is the women's rights thing. We've only discussed it sort of evocatively, but certainly not thoroughly. But the sexuality thing, one of the things that Wahlberg says is that in the two things that Jesus says to her at the end, and what are they? Nor do I condemn you. And then the translation here is, go and do not sin again. To his credit, Brown's translation is, you may go, but from now on avoid this sin. He doesn't make it so blanket. Tracing the scholarship in her very interesting way, Wahlberg says most of the commentators have emphasized point two of Jesus' admonition. Don't do this again. Not point one, nor do I condemn you. And she makes the point, and I think I'll stop there and let some of you react. She makes the point that that is a threat to our sloganizing and our tradition that really, when the truth is known, the worst sins are sexual sins. And she makes the point that that's not what Jesus is saying. And it's very interesting if you look at the whole Gospel of John. That's maybe one reason why this Gospel text made a successful landing finally in John rather than elsewhere. Jesus does not in John work the guilt thing as much as other Gospels. Jesus is interested in John, in what you see and what you do, and whether you throw your lot in totally with him. Anyone who believes has already passed from death to life, and there's a new thing going on, like the new thing that went on for her, which was, I'm not going to die after all. I'm going to live. I'm going to live. That's her experience, right? She said she was scared to death. She was scared to death. And when everybody with stones in their hands left, she was alive. Now, what are your comments? We've got 3 minutes left.
Okay, one thing maybe totally tangential but goes to my mind is the whole thing that's becoming more known is working with women in authority abuse situations where it's still perceived it's a woman's fault, even though it's the psychologist or the doctor or the pastor or the teacher that has essentially abused her sexually. And yet, I mean, even society a lot of times is still saying it's the woman that's at fault for that. And it starts me to...
This text comes right into the middle of all the boiling and passion that is coming out of taking the lid off the oppression of women.
The one thought I had was in light of Anita Hill's message this morning about ups and downs.
Yeah.
Jesus was helping the one that was down.
He has her talk. He addresses her and sees her as a person. And ask her, where are they all? Yeah. Is anyone left?
You have to.
Again, pardon me, she's got a speaking part. The men don't. It's like, didn't have a speaking part.
She's more important than they are in this one. Well, you know, you have to look at this as an interpretation of challenging the authority of one reason that I think that priest is so scared is because in the Catholic Church, the priesthood has such a hierarchy and such an authority over women. In the past, in the Catholic Church.
What do you mean, in the past?
Well, yeah. All right, I'm saying, you know,
Where are you living?
Okay. But what I'm saying is that because of the way he treats her, he's saying,